Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, March 21st, 2022. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson telling senators on the Judiciary Committee she is humbled and honored to be the first African-American woman nominated to the High Court. And if confirmed, she would defend the Constitution and decide cases without fear or favor. Committee senators also making their opening statements on this first day of the hearings. Democrats generally defending the nominee's record. Republicans signaling some of the issues they plan to bring up during the questioning the next couple of days, including Judge Jackson's rulings on criminal cases. President Joe Biden heading to Europe this week to discuss Russia's continuing war against Ukraine with NATO leaders, and just added a visit to Poland, which borders Ukraine, also a NATO member, to meet with refugees from the war. We'll talk about what President Biden is looking to accomplish on the trip with Heritage Foundation National Security Senior Fellow Richard Brooks. Biden administration also warning of evolving intelligence suggesting the Russian government is exploring options for potential cyber attacks against the United States. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell telling a business conference inflation is much too high and puts an otherwise strong U.S. economy in jeopardy. He promises to take tough action, including raising interest rates potentially faster at more than a quarter percentage point increments that has been signaled so far. From the Associated Press, the Senate Judiciary Committee opening Supreme Court confirmation hearings Monday with Republicans promising pointed questions for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and Democrats full of praise for the first black woman nominated for the nation's highest court. We'll hear from the senators in a moment, but first, Judge Jackson telling the senators how she has approached her job as a judge and, if confirmed, what kind of Supreme Court justice she will be.
Members of this committee, if I am confirmed, I commit to you that I will work productively to support and defend the Constitution and this grand experiment of American democracy that has endured over these past 246 years. I have been a judge for nearly a decade now, and I take that responsibility and my duty to be independent very seriously. I decide cases from a neutral posture. I evaluate the facts, and I interpret and apply the law to the facts of the case before me without fear or favor, consistent with my judicial oath. I know that my role as a judge is a limited one, that the Constitution empowers me only to decide cases and controversies that are properly presented. And I know that my judicial role is further constrained by careful adherence to precedent. Now, in preparing for these hearings, you may have read some of my more than 570 written decisions, and you may have also noticed that my opinions tend to be on the long side. That is because I also believe in transparency, that people should know precisely what I think and the basis for my decision. And all of my professional experiences, including my work as a public defender and as a trial judge, have instilled in me the importance of having each litigant know that the judge in their case has heard them, whether or not their arguments prevail in court. During this hearing, I hope that you will see how much I love our country and the Constitution and the rights that make us free. I stand on the shoulders of so many who have come before me, including Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman to be appointed to the federal bench and with whom I share a birthday. And like Judge Motley, I have dedicated my career to ensuring that the words engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building, "Equal Justice Under Law," are a reality and not just an ideal. Thank you for this historic chance to join the highest court, to work with brilliant colleagues to inspire future generations and to ensure liberty and justice for all.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, part of her opening statement before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She also cited retiring Justice Stephen Breyer as her judicial model, saying that if confirmed, she would hope to carry on his spirit. Jackson is 51 years old, once clerk for Breyer, retiring now at the age of 83. The newspaper Roll Call writes, the Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Ketanji Brown Jackson kicked off Monday with Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee using their opening statements to try to head off some Republican criticisms. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, a former judiciary chairman himself, said Jackson is no judicial activist and is not anti-law enforcement or soft on crime.
I'm proud of being a former prosecutor, but confidence in my prosecution of a case was strongest when I knew the defendant had the best possible representation. When both sides and the presiding judge have a real grasp of our criminal justice system, that's when justice is most likely to be done. So I would say that Judge Jackson's background is not a liability to the court. It's a much needed asset to the court. And since her nomination, again here today, we've heard about the long distinguished record of Judge Jackson, graduate of Harvard, Harvard Law School, a judicial clerk at the district, circuit, and Supreme Court level, a federal appellate judge, a federal district court judge, a member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission, an attorney in private practice, and a federal public defender. What a resume. All these experiences and perspectives have provided her a mastery of our justice system. And I'd say in particular the criminal justice system. If she is confirmed, she would become the first ever justice to have served as a federal public defender. That's an important experience given how much the court shapes our criminal justice system. I say that from my experience as a senator, but also my experience for nearly a decade as a prosecutor. And perhaps most of all, it is Judge Jackson's nearly 10 years as an appellate and trial judge to underscore the experience she would bring to the Supreme Court. She was confirmed unanimously by the Senate in 2013 to the D.C. Circuit Court. She served with distinction for 8 years. She issued more than 500 opinions. She presided over a dozen trials. And a bipartisan majority of the Senate confirmed her to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals last year. Let's be honest. She's a fair and impartial jurist with a fidelity to the law above all else. That's what Americans want to see in a Supreme Court justice. Years of so-called judicial wars have left Americans feeling like our courts have become increasingly partisan. The extreme interests of pressure groups of both sides of the political spectrum have left the American people wondering if they can get a fair shake in our courts. And yet, in this moment, we have before us a unique opportunity to change that narrative. I'm under no illusion that we can mend this process overnight. But we have before us a nominee who has brought us together across party lines before, and one I hope we can bring us back together again.
Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, part of his opening statement at the Judiciary Committee hearing for Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Opening statements today, all 22 members of the committee spending about 10 minutes each. The questioning begins on Tuesday, live coverage at 9 a.m. Eastern. Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, using his opening statement to preview some of the questions he plans to ask the nominee. They will include the judge's rulings in cases related to child pornography.
So let me say a few things that I'm concerned about, aspects of your record that trouble me. This will come as no surprise. I've said it in public already, but I want to be, again, very candid in the interest of an open and honest discussion and specific. So here are, I hope, in the next couple of days, some of the cases from your time on the on the court, the district court, the federal district court, that I hope that we can talk about. Let me just run through a few of them so you know exactly which ones I mean. United States versus Hawkins. This was a child pornography case where the defendant distributed multiple images of child porn, possessed dozens more, including videos. The federal sentencing guidelines recommended a sentence of 97 to 121 months in prison. Prosecutors recommended 24 months in prison. Judge Jackson gave the defendant 3 months in prison. United States versus Chazen. That case, the defendant possessed 48 files of child pornography. The federal guidelines recommended 78 to 97 months in prison. The prosecutor recommended the same. Judge Jackson sentenced him to 28 months. United States versus Cooper. There, the defendant possessed dozens of images of child pornography and distributed dozens of images of child pornography, possessed over 600. The federal guidelines recommended 151 to 188 months in prison. That's a long time. The prosecutor recommended 72 months. Judge Jackson gave the defendant 60 months, which was the lowest sentence permitted by the law. United States versus Down, that's a case where the defendant distributed 33 graphic images and videos of child sexual assault to an anonymous messaging app. Unfortunately, practice that's becoming more common. The federal guidelines recommended 70 to 87 months in prison. The prosecutor recommended 70 months in prison. Judge Jackson sentenced him to only 60 months. Again, that's the lowest level that was permitted by law in that case. United States versus Stewart, the defendant there distributed scores of images of children suffering sexual abuse. The guidelines recommended 97 to 121 months in prison. The prosecutor recommended 97 months in prison. Judge Jackson gave him 57 months. In United States versus Sears, the defendant distributed over 100 videos of child pornography. The guidelines recommended 97 to 121 months in prison. The prosecutor recommended 97 months in prison. Judge Jackson gave him 71 months.
Republican Senator Josh Hawley running through some of the cases that he plans to bring up with Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Today was only opening statements. The questioning begins on Tuesday. The Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, responding to Senator Hawley, saying what he has done has been discredited already by the Washington Post, ABC News, CNN, and a writer from the National Review. So in my mind, we know there's no substance behind it. There's a big story to be told that Hawley is leaving out. Another Republican senator on the committee, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, using his opening statement to, as the Hill newspaper puts it, fume over progressive criticism of J. Michelle Childs, a district court nominee who was also a Supreme Court contender.
Now, President Biden had a choice here, and he has every right to make it. Elections have consequences. He had many qualified African-American women to choose from. He chose you. Michelle Childs, a district court judge from South Carolina, supported by Jim Clyburn. That was in the mix. I think it came down to about two, three, four people. Don't know for sure, but that's what the press was reporting. And when it came to Judge Childs, this Arabella group, Senator Whitehouse, you talk about dark money, you may be onto something. This Arabella group is funded by Soros and some other liberal billionaire. They got so many groups in their group, I can't name them all now. But they basically said, if you pick Childs, you may have a primary opponent. The FL-CIO said Judge Childs was a union buster. The attacks from the left against Judge Childs was really pretty vicious, to be honest with you. So you say, Judge Jackson, you don't have any judicial philosophy per se. Well, somebody on the left believes you do. Or they wouldn't have spent the money they spent to have you in this chair. So we're going to find out how that statement holds up over time. A viewer's guide to this hearing. She will be asked about her sentencing practices as a district court judge, and she'll have a chance to explain her reasoning, and you can make up for yourself what this means, but it's good to be asked. About her legal views, I'll ask her about the law of armed conflict and her view of the law of armed conflict. The fact that you represent a Gitmo detainees is not a problem with me. Everybody deserves a lawyer. You're doing their country a great service when you defend the most unpopular people. But I do want to know about your amicus briefs after you're no longer a defense counsel weighing into the Supreme Court about how they decide law of war issues. That matters a lot to me. I think it does matter that the groups that came to your aid at the expense of Judge Childs, how did that happen and why were they doing what they were doing? What is it about your nomination that the most liberal people under umbrella of Arabella threw in their money, their time, their support, and threatened Joe Biden if he picked Judge Childs? I want to know more about that. I want to know about your judicial philosophy, because people on the left, the far extreme part of the left, believe that you were the best bet. And I want to know why they reached that conclusion. Maybe there's no explanation you can give us, but we'll talk about that. Now, when we say this is not Kavanaugh, what do we mean? It means that Democratic senators are not going to have their windows busted by groups. That's what it means. It means that no Republican senator is going to unleash on you an attack about your character when the hearing is virtually over. None of us, I hope, have been sitting on information about you as a person for weeks or months. You come into our offices and we never share it with you to allow you to give your side of the story. We wait to the very last minute when the hearing's about to be gavel concluded and say, oh, by the way, I've got this letter. And so happened that every media outlet in the country had the letter too. So the next morning there were headlines all over the country, really, accusing Judge Kavanaugh of being basically Bill Cosby. None of us are going to do that to you.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, his opening statement on the first day of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Day two is Tuesday, begins at 9 a.m. Eastern. That's when the senators will have an opportunity to ask the judge questions, each senator getting a half an hour in the first round. There are 22 senators on the committee. The questioning could easily spill into Wednesday. We'll have live coverage Tuesday, 9 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app. A Monmouth University poll published today finding that 55% of the respondents saying they believe the judge should be confirmed to the Supreme Court. 21% say she should not, 24% offering no opinion. And President Biden tweeting today, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is a brilliant legal mind with the utmost character and integrity. She deserves to be confirmed as the next justice of the Supreme Court. This is Washington Today. Current Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas missing today's oral argument in a case heard as he recovers in the hospital from an infection. Chief Justice John Roberts opening up the oral argument mentioning that.
Today's orders of the court have been duly entered and certified and filed with the clerk. Justice Thomas is unable to be present today, but will participate in consideration and decision of the cases on the basis of the briefs and the transcripts of oral argument.
That's Chief Justice John Roberts opening up today's oral argument. A Supreme Court statement Sunday night saying Justice Clarence Thomas's illness is not related to COVID-19, that he is fully vaccinated and boosted, that he has flu-like symptoms and is being treated with intravenous antibiotics, that his symptoms are abating, he's resting comfortably, expected to be released from the hospital in the next day or two. Justice Thomas is 73 years old, currently the longest-serving justice on the Supreme Court. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. A Food and Drug Administration advisory panel will be meeting April 6th to discuss COVID-19 vaccine booster doses. Both Pfizer and Moderna have filed applications for emergency use authorization for a second booster dose of their vaccines. Moderna for all U.S. adults and Pfizer for those 65 and older. Securities and Exchange Commission proposing to require all publicly traded companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions and the risks they face from climate change. Could apply to hundreds of companies. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing late Congressman Dodd Young, Republican from Alaska, the longest-serving Republican representative in the history of Congress, will be lying in state in National Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol next week. Young died on Friday at the age of 88. He had served in the U.S. House since 1973, just over 49 years. From NBC News, the nearly month-long Russian invasion in Ukraine is on the verge of entering a stalemate, a senior NATO intelligence official said Monday, with Ukrainian forces preventing Russia from making progress, but Russian President Vladimir Putin showing no willingness to back down. The NATO official, speaking on condition of anonymity, to discuss sensitive military assessments, telling NBC, if we're not in a stalemate, we are rapidly approaching one. The reality is neither side has a superiority over the other. Meanwhile, the White House urging private companies in the U.S. to increase their cyber defenses, saying intelligence suggests the Russian government is exploring options for potential cyber attacks targeting U.S. critical infrastructure. Briefing with reporters, the White House Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology, Ann Neuberger.
The evolving intelligence doesn't mean that it's a certainty there's going to be an attack. Can you explain for the layman what you are seeing right now that precipitated this statement today and what the evolving intelligence may be now compared to on the 24th or prior to the invasion?
Absolutely. So the first part of that is you've seen the administration continuously lean forward and share even fragmentary pieces of information we have to drive and ensure maximum preparedness by the private sector. So as soon as we learned about that, last week we hosted classified briefings with companies and sectors we felt would be most affected and provided very practical, focused advice. Today's broader unclassified briefing is to raise that broader awareness and to raise that call to action.
So there was something specific you saw last week that was raised to the industries that it would have affected, is what you're saying.
So I want to reiterate, there is no evidence of any specific cyber attack that we're anticipating for. There is some preparatory activity that we're seeing, and that is what we shared in a classified context with companies who we thought might be affected. And then we're lifting up a broader awareness here in this warning.
Major? And when you say a call to action, many who hear you say that might believe that something is imminent. Is it?
So first, a call to action is because there are cyber attacks that occur every day. Hundreds of millions of dollars were paid in ransoms by U.S. companies just last year against criminal activity happening in the U.S. today. Every single day, there should be a call to action. We're using the opportunity of this evolving threat intelligence regarding potential cyber attacks against critical infrastructure to reiterate those with additional focus specifically to critical infrastructure owners and operators to say you have the responsibility to take these steps to protect the critical services Americans rely on.
As a follow-up, critical infrastructure is a broad term.
Mm-hmm.
Is it as broad as you typically mean it when the government speaks about critical infrastructure, or is there something you've seen that you can be more a little bit more specific within that large frame of critical infrastructure?
I won't get into specific sectors at this time because the steps that are needed to lock our digital doors need to be done across every sector of critical infrastructure. And even those sectors that we do not see any specific threat intelligence for, we truly want those sectors to double down and do the work that's needed.
Ann Neuberger is Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology, leading off today's White House briefing with reporters. Following her, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, who was asked about President Biden's trip this week to Europe, a meeting with the leaders of NATO in Brussels, and then off to Poland.
Go ahead.
Can you walk us through the president's trip a little bit later this week? We know he's going to stop in Brussels first, obviously, then he goes to Poland, as you announced this weekend. Will he see refugees? Will he deliver a speech? Are there deliverables? Can you walk us through what you can tell us?
There will certainly be deliverables, as there always are on these trips. And there always are. We're still finalizing, believe it or not, the details of the trip and the specifics of what he'll be doing while he's in Poland. He, of course, will be seeing his counterpart there, and he will certainly thank him for the efforts and the work that that Poland has done and the leaders have done there to welcome refugees, to get them settled in Poland for this time being, as devastating as the circumstances are. Jake Sullivan is going to be joining us here tomorrow, and hopefully by then we will have more specifics to lay out for all of you, but we're finalizing the details as we speak.
More on President Biden's trip to Europe this week to meet with the leaders of NATO countries to discuss the response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We're joined on the phone by Peter Brooks, Senior Research Fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for being here. What does President Biden want to accomplish on this trip, and what do the European leaders want to accomplish, and are they the same thing?
Yeah, I'm glad the president's going, but I wish he'd gone earlier. I mean, we're in the fourth week of this terrible war in Ukraine. I think there's going to be an effort to, you know, show solidarity, transatlantic solidarity. He's going to supposedly meet with NATO, European Council, G7, and may actually travel to Poland. So I think it's going to be highly symbolic, an effort on their part to show transatlantic solidarity. I think there's also, I think there's probably likely that there will be some major announcements in terms of what the transatlantic community is willing to do in terms of support for Ukraine, whether that's more weapons such as, you know, air defense systems, air assets. I mean, I would like to see these MiG-29s transferred to Ukraine. I'd like to see there's ways we can do this, I think, still. There could be more financial support, more sanctions. I mean, there's a possibility that the Europeans will say that they will put a ban on Russian oil. I'd like to see out of this, and I hope we see, is that we're doing more faster. And, of course, the moral support element is critically important to show unity with what the Ukrainians are going through.
Republicans in the House and Senate over the past 2 weeks or so have been pushing President Biden to do more. President Biden's been saying he's not going to risk World War III. What do you make of that debate?
It's an important debate, right? From my perspective, I'd like to see us saying more of what we'll do rather than what we won't do. I think we need to keep everything on the table for the purposes of keeping Putin off balance. We may decide that a no-fly zone is not a good idea. We may decide other options are not a good idea. But we can discuss that within within the U.S. policy community, within the U.S. executive branch, with our friends and allies in Europe. So I think that's that's critically important here. I think U.S. leadership is not only needed but wanted on this issue in Europe and elsewhere. And I think we're dealing with a situation where we're really in a war between authoritarianism and democracy and democratic leaning states.
Some Republicans in Congress also been saying that we need to stop acting like Ukraine will lose eventually. Is the Biden administration thinking like that? And does Ukraine really have a chance to win this?
Well, I hope they're not thinking that way. I actually personally, obviously war is very dynamic, but I think we're at an inflection point. I think there's seemingly a change in Russian strategy. And if we can do more faster, I think we will have an effect on the outcome. And I'm quite bullish on Ukraine. If we can give them the support that they need, they've shown tremendous military and political resiliency. And I think we should support this. I mean, we're talking about an unjust, unprovoked war initiated by Putin. And I think it needs to be pushed he and Russia needs to be pushed back. Otherwise, we could, if he's emboldened or successful, we could see this terrible situation spread beyond Ukraine.
We're talking with Peter Brooks from the Heritage Foundation. Also, a lot of talk lately about biological and chemical weapons. If Russia were to go down that path, what should be the U.S. and NATO response?
Well, there should be a strong response. I don't want to get into hypotheticals here. And it is possible that Putin could even use nuclear weapons, right? Besides chemical and biological weapons, there's been talk about the Russian strategy of escalate to de-escalate. You've probably heard about that, using tactical nuclear weapons, especially if Russia feels that things are not going its way at a conventional level. We could see it, and I hate to see this, certainly, where you might see chemical weapons used in an urban environment between Ukrainian and Russian forces and against Ukrainian civilians. That would be terrible. And then, of course, we have this situation where the administration has shared intelligence with us that the Russians might use the idea of a chemical weapons attack perpetrated against the Russian armed forces or against Ukrainians and blaming it on Ukrainian forces or even NATO as a pretext or a false flag operation to increase the violence or justify their unjust invasion into Ukraine. So this is something we need to be very concerned about. We need to be prepared to deal with. We need to be prepared to respond. But it's very difficult to speak about hypothetical situations when you're talking about chemical nuclear or biological weapons, considering how many different ways they can be used.
In February, I saw that you wrote before the invasion about Russia's advantage over the U.S. in low-yield nuclear weapons. What point were you making in that article?
Well, a lot of points. Obviously, I titled it, Russia's small nukes are a big problem. It turns out that Russia has about 2,000 low-yield tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons. The United States has about 200, 100 of them in Europe and 100 of them back here in the United States. And what I was talking about, as I referred to earlier, Michael, was this escalate to de-escalate strategy where the Russians could pop off a low-yield nuclear weapon. I mean, a lot of people look at me strange when I talk about low-yield nuclear weapons, right? But these are smaller weapons than we might see used in a situation where the Russians send an intercontinental ballistic missile our way. You know, these aren't city busters necessarily, but they can do a tremendous amount of damage, obviously, right? Very serious stuff. So what the Russians might do is that they might use these or even one, say if they even fired it off and over the ocean and it exploded, that it would be meant to signal to those who are involved in the Ukraine crisis or to Ukraine that worse things could be coming. So this is a tremendous concern. And the real concern is that the Russians have never allowed these weapons to be included in arms control agreements. Like, it's not under the new START treaty, which is the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that was renewed by the Biden administration and obviously done under the Obama administration. These weapons have never been put under there. So the Russians have some people say they have 1,000, some people say 2,000. So somewhere between a 10 and 20 to one advantage over the United States and NATO. And there's concerns that the Russians see this as a warfighting weapon, not as just a deterrent weapon to prevent people from doing things, but this is something that they could actually use. And obviously that would break the 75-year taboo on the use of these weapons in warfare.
Peter Brooks is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, specializing in national security and foreign policy. You can follow him on Twitter at Brooks_Peter and his work at heritage.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Russia's foreign ministry is saying today it summoned U.S. Ambassador John Sullivan to tell him that President Joe Biden's calling Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal had pushed ties between the U.S. and Russia to the brink of collapse. Facebook owner Meta labeled an extremist organization today by a Moscow court, but the decision is not going to apply to its WhatsApp messenger service instead of focusing on Instagram and Facebook, which are already banned. Russia banned Facebook for restricting access to Russian media, and Instagram was blocked after Meta said it would allow social media users in Ukraine to post messages urging violence against President Putin and troops that Russia has sent into Ukraine. And a 96-year-old Holocaust survivor was killed on Friday by a Russian strike on the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, the death confirmed in a series of tweets by the Buchenwald Concentration Camp Memorial Institute. U.S. Today determining that Myanmar's military government's violent repression of the largely Muslim Rohingya population starting in 2017 amounts to genocide. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying there's evidence that the thousands of killings, the mass rape, the arson, cleared intent to destroy the Rohingya.
Beyond the Holocaust, the United States has concluded the genocide was committed 7 times. Today marks the 8th, as I have determined that members of the Burmese military committed genocide and crimes against humanity against Rohingya. It's a decision that I reached based on reviewing a factual assessment and legal analysis prepared by the State Department, which included detailed documentation by a range of independent, impartial sources, including human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, as well as our own rigorous fact-finding.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken making the announcement at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. A case against Myanmar, also known as Burma, was opened at the International Criminal Court in 2019. From CNBC, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell on Monday vowed tough action on inflation, which he said jeopardizes an otherwise strong economic recovery. He spoke to the National Association for Business Economics. The speech comes less than a week after the Fed raised interest rates for the first time in more than 3 years in an attempt to battle inflation that is running at its highest level in 40 years. Reiterating a position the Federal Open Market Committee made Wednesday in its post-meeting statement, Powell said interest rate hikes would continue until inflation is under control. He said the increases could even be higher if necessary than the quarter percentage point move approved at the meeting. That from CNBC. Here's part of today's event with Chair Powell interviewed by Constant Hunter from AIG.
So there are a number of questions about stagflation, which we all know is high unemployment and high inflation. That is, I think, not the situation we have now, even though people have bandied that word about. And I guess my question centers more around, you know, we had come to believe the bigger boogeyman was deflation or disinflation. And that, of course, was informed by nearly 40 years of inflation falling and interest rates, nominal rates falling. And were we maybe a little bit too quick to declare victory over inflation? And do you still think the prevailing wisdom, certainly in the halls of the Fed, is that disinflation, deflation is the bigger boogeyman? Or is inflation the boogeyman that has come back and is the bigger boogeyman?
So... All right, so clearly for the last quarter century, we've had a perfect storm of disinflationary forces, really. Demographics, globalization, technology all came together to create disinflationary forces. Now, it's been argued that there's a number of books that argue that that process is over and that we're going to go into a higher inflationary situation. I hadn't found that argument persuasive before the pandemic, and so the question is: we've now had, since that old regime, what's happened is we had a pandemic, we had very historically strong policy support from fiscal policy and monetary policy, and now we have a war that is generating untold, really uncertain economic constraints. And the question is, as we come out the other side of that, it's a really good question. The question is, what will be the nature of that economy? Are we going to go back to slower growth, low productivity, aging population, globalization to some extent still intact? Or are we going to go back to a more segmented global economy where the effects of globalization on anyone's ability to raise the price of anything are diminished? And I guess it's really hard to say. But I don't think no one is sitting around at the Fed or anywhere else that I know of just waiting for the old regime to come back. Mm. I think people fully appreciate the situation that we're in. It's a series of shocks and events that have happened, and we have a job to do, and we're very focused on doing that job.
The Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, actually technically acting chair because he has not been confirmed by the Senate to that second term, interviewed by Constance Hunter, AIG Chief Business Economist and Executive Vice President at today's annual policy conference of the National Association of Business Economics held in Washington, D.C. Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling 201, NASDAQ down 55, S&P down 1. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more top Washington stories sent right to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. Hope you have a good night.